Greetings and welcome to Lobes and Robes, How Neuroscience Can Change the World. This podcast is sponsored by the American University Center for Neuroscience and Behavior and explores the links between neuroscience and key policy questions today. I'm Susan Carl, a professor of law at American University Washington College of Law, and I will help lead discussions throughout our series along with Dr. Terry Davidson, director of the Center for Neuroscience and Behavior at American University and a distinguished professor of neuroscience here. This podcast is for anyone interested in how scientific discovery can make the world a better place. Thanks for listening.
Welcome, everybody. Today, we are going to do a four-way conversation to take some of the ideas that we explored in our last interview with Dr. Tara White and bring them in conversation with an expert on the legal aspects of dignity. And so for that purpose, we have a wonderful collaborator, somebody I've just started to get to know, James May, who is a distinguished professor of law at the Delaware Law School. He is the founder of the Environmental Rights Institute and the co-founder of the Dignity Rights Project with another wonderful colleague of his, Aaron Daly. He has served as the H. Albert Young Fellow on Constitutional Law at Delaware Law School, and he has taught in many, many institutions, many in the United States, but also he's had visiting appointments on the faculty at the Pakistan College of Law, a law school in Brazil, a school in Paris, England, and Spain. And I believe in all of these visiting appointments, he's been doing a cross-cultural examination of the concept of dignity law jurisprudence. His program has a wonderful website that collects cases from all over the world that I found very useful in my own research. So we thought it would be interesting to just put Professor May, who I'll call Jimmy since I know him, put Jimmy in conversation with Tara and Terry Davidson and myself. So welcome, Jimmy.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So maybe, Jimmy, you could start by just telling us a little bit about your work on dignity law and how your taxonomy, how you kind of put together the various aspects of law as it enhances dignity rights. Just give us sort of the really basic overview of the work you do.
And by the way, thank you, Susan and Terry, for inviting me. And Tara, I really look forward to this conversation about the relationship between neuroscience and dignity under law. So where I fit into this is as a lawyer and a law professor, which just means that my interest in dignity is its role in law and how law also translates into dignity. What that means is that it's not the same, but it's also very related to international human rights law. So the concept of human dignity means, quite simply, that every person has inherent equal worth. And that's explained in what Susan and many others have written about. So this idea of inherent equal worth, it doesn't mean everyone is equal. It just means that there's inherent equal worth. And then it's a fundamental attribute of human existence. It's also nothing new and nothing that's only for Western cultures. It's reflected in Ubuntu traditions and Africa and the Golden Rule, and it's about decency, respect, and civility. What we see how dignity is reflected in law is basically in two ways. The first way is in constitutions. There are 194 UN-recognized countries with constitutions. Dignity is reflected in a vast majority of those, so about north of 165 countries have constitutions that reflect the right to human dignity. So it's a constitutional right. That's one way to think about it. The other way is in dignity jurisprudence. There are cases all around the globe, thousands of cases from hundreds of courts construing and interpreting what it means to have a dignity right. So those of us who are enthusiasts of American constitutional law, it's a really new concept. It's a different kind of concept because the federal constitution does not reflect a right to human dignity. And only one state does. That's the state of Montana. So the constitution for the state of Montana reflects it, but no other state. Also, the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico guarantees a right to human dignity. So in sort of North American constitutional law speak, it has very little purchase. But all around the globe, South America and Africa and Eastern Europe and in Asia and Pacific Asia, dignity plays a huge role in improving people's lives. And the connection to neuroscience, and again, I have to say I'm not a neuroscientist, so I'm entirely out of my depth when we talk about it. What I'm learning that makes it so interesting is that it's kind of a primitive idea that dignity isn't just an idea. It's deeply ingrained and entrained in neurologically in human beings. And that is reflected ultimately in law.
I agree. I think that that insight, which is Tara's paper that we focused on last interview, is really promising and interesting. Tara, I'm wondering, do you have any sort of initial responses to what Jimmy just said? Does it resonate with you in any particular way?
No, absolutely it does. And you say you're not an expert in neuroscience, so I'm certainly no expert in law. So I so appreciate the strengths that you're bringing to this concept of dignity rights and Dignity Law Project is just incredible. I mean, for me, it's in my thinking about the ways that dignity is expressed in the human nervous system over time and the way that what we know about neuroscience can help fortify these concepts of unconditional rights and value. It's just really interesting for me to hear about the history on the legal side as to how that these ideas have sort of flowed and developed and crystallized over time. So it's just really fascinating to me that I think there's a convergence here. And in some ways, I think they're very complementary. And I'm really, for me, I would really like to explore with you, you know, all three of you, the ways in which we might be able to use, you know, these ideas in neuroscience as to how they can fortify these really important initiatives at the domestic and the international level.
I agree so much. Jimmy, I want to add one point, and this isn't going to surprise you that I'm going to add it, which is that even though the U.S. Constitution doesn't use the word dignity rights, as we know, there are many rights that are articulated in the U.S. Constitution. And if you go back and say, what unites all of these? What's the concept that makes them all make sense? Dignity is a pretty good term to use. And of course, that's what Justice Brennan, and you know this because you've read my paper, Justice Brennan's whole idea about what he should be doing as a justice was enhancing dignity in every way that he could. And so even though the U.S. Constitution was written before the UN declaration that articulates the concept of dignity rights, but it maybe it underlies it. Maybe it is one of the historical antecedents to this modern concept of dignity rights. Do you think that is a fair way to talk about U.S. constitutional law?
Yes, I think it's fair. And I think Alexander Hamilton would agree with you, by the way. You know, when he was advocating for ratification of the Bill of Rights, he said that the Constitution was the best way for securing dignity. And so the framers of the U.S. Constitution, you know, were aware of the idea, and many equated it with natural law, which kind of gets back to the, at least, again, I'm like using neuroscience on myself here, but the way I'm translating what I'm learning about neuroscience and dignity and that Tara and her colleagues have written so eloquently about is that, you know, it's such an important concept and it's something that we can talk about. Susan, like you said, we can deconstruct U.S. constitutional law and look at the extent to which the Supreme Court and the framers have addressed it. But really, I think my takeaway is it's in law because it has to be, because it's neurologically, again, you know, connected to human existence. And in law, you know, we see it sort of, you know, develop. But again, that's an extension of the neuroscience that feeds it. I could be way off on that, but that's the sense that I get.
Jimmy, I have a question. And that is, as a neuroscientist, we deal with abstracts in terms of constructs like memory and dignity, of course, is one of those, motivation and so on. And I was interested in you indicated that Montana and Puerto Rico had codified dignity into their laws somehow. And so it seemed to me that they would have to define that. Can you give us any more information about how dignity might be defined in the law?
Sure, I can try. But let me first say there isn't, as many, you know, have noted before, part of what limits dignity is that it doesn't enjoy a singular definition. From my perspective, my taxonomy of dignity, if you will, is that it has four essential qualities. And let me just say that these qualities don't just come off the top of my head. They're reflected largely in jurisprudence. So, you know, like when judges try to apply a right to human dignity in a constitution in an actual case, they'll often try to answer the question you just asked, you know, what does it mean? I think it's just helpful to have a taxonomy. So here's the taxonomy in law anyway, is these four pieces. First, that each person, every member of the human family has value, and that no one can be dismissed, ignored, mistreated, or abused as if their humanity doesn't mean anything. And dignity means that each person's humanity has equal worth. So that's number one. Number two is that each person's worth is equal to every other person's, that no one's life, is more important than any other person's. And that if each person's right to agency, as Tara has written about, to self-development, to choose one's life choices, is the same as everyone else's. And that no one can determine another person's choices, treat another as an object, or treat a person as if her or his life doesn't matter. And the idea is sort of, this is sort of echoes at least Hannah Arendt's idea of dignity, is that it's in dignity that we are united. So third is that dignity inheres in the human person. So if you're, you know, human beings have this inherent right. And the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which in law arguably was the kind of sum and substance of dignity, not only in 1948 when it was adopted, but since then. But the UDHR defines the scope and time and space about dignity. It applies to every person born into the human family. And it requires only birth, not the granting or conferral of dignity by someone with greater dignity, which is, you know, not possible. But this is critically important for just understanding dignity's relationship to law, that human dignity transcends positive law. And again, maybe that gets to the neuroscience of it. And fourth is that dignity is universal. It applies to every member of the human family, wherever and whenever they live. And so that means that within it is a principle of intergenerational equity, in that those who are born after me, after you, after my children, they have the same dignity. And that every person who has ever been born or whoever will be born has the same quantum of dignity. We don't have to prove it. We don't have to earn it. It's a part of human existence. And so that got me, so as a legal matter, those four components about inherence and universality and equal worth and so on. So that got me thinking about, well, where does this come from? You know, dignity has been written about for thousands of years. It's an Aristotelian concept, arguably even predates that. It's sort of, you know, who we are and how do we relate to each other. And I guess that gets back to the kind of the neuroscience of dignity that I think is so incredibly interesting, and whether the law sufficiently supports what's the neurology that's involved with recognizing our worth and everyone else's equal worth along the way. So let me throw that out there as well.
Yeah, that's amazing. So when you lay that out, I see a lot of mapping between your taxonomy and Tara's article. And she divides dignity up into a series of different components. And they include things like freedom from degrading treatment and abuse, and the rights to physical security, the right to develop uniquely, which I hear you talking about in a very similar terms in number two, that everybody's equal worth means that they have agency and they have a right to self-development and life choices without other people determining them. Tara's discussion about autonomy and self-determination. I hear this consilience there. I'm wondering, Tara, what do you note that as well?
Oh, absolutely. For me, and you know, these ideas in dignity neuroscience as to how neuroscience can support these ideas of universal human rights and dignity, the entire framework is sort of extracted from the structure of international human rights law. So these five domains of agency, freedom from want, freedom from fear, uniqueness, and unconditional belonging to the human family, I extracted them from the structure of what has been, you know, agreed upon internationally since, you know, 1948 in the Universal Declaration. So I would say that they're converging in part because Dignity Neuroscience is growing out of just reading about and trying to understand, you know, the nature of these rights that are in these legal documents. So they don't come from an independent source.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Not only that, if I could throw in there too, as Tara just mentioned, you know, we see dignity reflected in so much law. The Uber Treaty is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It actually appeared in an international or regional agreement in the American Convention on Human Rights just a couple of years preceding that. And the first time we saw it in a constitution in law is actually in Mexico in 1914. But what we see is a progression of dignity in law at the domestic and at the regional and at the international level. So if you look at that, like the international level, the UDHR guarantees, reflects everyone's worth and dignity. And then we see that reflected in regional agreements that are protect civil and political rights and social, economic, and cultural rights through the international covenants that were adopted in 1966. Dignity is the only common feature between those two covenants. In essence, the civil and political covenant that the United States is a part of reflects Western values about what human rights are, you know, the right to vote, freedom of expression, that sort of thing, whereby Eastern Global South constitutions tend to reflect, have a different concept of dignity, if you will, and reflect and respect different kinds of rights. What are thought of as socioeconomic and cultural rights, like what Tara again has written about, you know, like freedom from want and unconditionality, you know, like rights to education, rights to a healthy environment, rights to clean water, rights to travel, rights to love, if you will. So we see that dignity in law is really getting back to Terry's question. It's reflected in law in different ways, and some of that is a product of kind of cultural dimensions. But what we see, getting back to the neuroscience of it, because I'm becoming a junior neuroscience advocate here, what we see is that what does connect people and places across constitutions, continents, countries, and cultures is dignity. At the international level, it's there. At the regional level, virtually every country on the planet has signed on to an accord that reflects and respects human dignity. And about three quarters of the human population on this planet are living under legal systems that, at least on paper, reflect and respect human dignity. And again, for me, I'm wondering if part of that is just because we can do nothing but do that because it's hardwired neurologically into who we are as human beings. But Tara, what do you think about that?
Well, you know, I think it's just so fascinating to me the ways in which we have convergence across these hugely different disciplines, each of which is repositories of knowledge over time, right? So you've got law, culture, philosophy, religion, and science are all attempts at establishing and understanding truth and what it means to be human. And I feel that these laws over time, you know, across all these different regions that you mentioned and across, you know, constitutional law and international law, the fact that it has this structure and that it is honoring the value, the equality, and the inherent importance of dignity and the unconditional quality of dignity, I just feel that, and also in the structure of the way these laws and ideals have been formulated, that it sort of beautifully reflects our common biology of what it means to be a human being, how we develop over time, the qualities in the environment that are necessary for flourishing, not just survival, but flourishing. It's just really wild and exciting to me that you can see this across these domains of scholarly interest, but also just sort of human inquiry, right? So I think that one of the reasons why it seems to me that law probably has developed this structure is that it is a reflection of what it is that we need to flourish neurologically. So I'm really pleased that the human neuroscience literature is robust enough at this point that we really can start to piece out the very specific ways in which we have data in humans that support these initiatives.
So I have a question that perhaps Tara and Jimmy will have some thoughts about. And that is that in neuroscience has been used in law. For example, there have been cases where people have committed violent acts and people who are expert in neuroscience or neurology will identify, say, tumors in a particular area of the brain that's been associated with rage. And more recently, there's been questions about when a fetus will feel pain. And I think sometimes the courts and the legal system ignores neuroscience. Sometimes they don't. I think I think it's about 28 weeks is the pretty much consensus view. The question here is, those are both cases in which neuroscience can add something to help the law. I'm wondering what type of neuroscience information, what neuroscientists might be able to do that would help the legal system within the domain of dignity.
Okay, well, I guess I'll start off because you use the expression the legal system.
By the way, I may be misusing it, so I'm sorry if I am.
Well, Tara, I'll give it a shot here. And I'm not dodging the question, but it's a really difficult one to answer. I mean, I think, first of all, look, it goes without saying that neuroscience plays a super important role in the development of laws. But just because there's the existence of science doesn't mean that legislators and lawyers will hold it, you know, up to the light of day, if you will, that it will make a difference. You know, just because something's legal doesn't mean it's moral, doesn't mean it's ethical, and also might work against the grain of neurology. All of that is possible. So with issues like that, with like reproductive rights, neuroscience can help inform the conversation about human dignity. So here's what dignity does that other human rights don't. It's both words and music. So here's what I mean. So dignity is a value, first of all. It reflects the values that Tara has written about, again, and others, and the taxonomy that I provided earlier about inherence and universality and so on. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights reflects this, that here's how it reads, and I feel like I'm duty-bound to just read it. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. So that's the words in law. But dignity is also the music. It's also what feeds our soul, what nourishes us as human beings, what makes us feel, you know, agency and autonomy and freedom from want and, you know, and unconditionality and the rest of it. And so dignity is a legal concept, and it's also a neurological concept. So getting back to your question, that can help inform any debate about any subject. And that's the magic of dignity under law, at least as I see it. I don't know of any other principle in law or in life that holds both of those things together. So, for example, in the reproductive rights arena, there are well-intentioned, well-reasoned people who have very different points of view about what reproductive rights there should be, about whether, for example, abortion should be outlawed or allowed, and if allowed, after how many weeks, you know, and this spills over into issues of the day about rights to, you know, what's called the abortion pill and so on and so forth. So these are chronically contested issues, period, full stop. But if we can frame issues like that through dignity, about how much, you know, dignity is owned to the unborn fetus, how much dignity is owned to the human being carrying the unborn fetus, the mother to be, then that can help, if you will, inform and also provide guardrails for a conversation that can be more constructive. So rather than in that context, and you've touched on arguably one of the most controversial contexts in, you know, the modern culture wars, for example, rather than pointing fingers or trying to differentiate between good and bad and right and wrong and the rest of it, which just contributes to conflict, is just to begin with dignity. So if everyone can agree that the end is dignity, then that can help inform the conversation. That gets back to dignity's role in law and society and in neuroscience as both the words and the music.
That's so lovely. I really like that. This conversation has led me, I've been starting to think about this, which is, Jimmy, you brought up the concept of natural rights, and especially in the founding period, of course, the political science and political theories that drove the Bill of Rights were based on natural rights theories. And that way of thinking about things has sort of fallen out of fashion for many people, but not everybody. But sometimes I wonder if our sense of something as being a natural right is connected to our neurology, you know, is connected to what Tara's saying, which is these are aspects of the human existence that need to be there in order for people to develop and achieve their potential. So I'm wondering if maybe natural rights is something neurological seen dimly through the human translation, cultural translation. Have any of you thought any about those questions?
Tara, do you have an answer to that?
I don't think there's an answer, but, you know, just thoughts.
So here I'm wondering what, because I know from the capabilities approach, they talk about positive rights and negative rights. I'm just wondering, and this is where I'm clearly no expert, and maybe Jimmy can tell me at least about what's the history of natural rights as a concept, and like how does modern, like contemporary law diverge from those original concepts? Because those are very old ideas that are rooted in like English law. If you could just speak to what those are and how they differ from these ideas, these more modern ideas.
Okay, so let me answer the second question you just raised first, which is there's much distance between 300-year-old or 250-year-old concepts of natural law and agency, autonomy, and self-determination. This is your taxonomy. That's first. Second is freedom from want. Third is freedom from fear. Fourth is uniqueness. And fifth is unconditionality. That reads to me, Tara, as an exposition of natural law. Now, in law, arguably, that taxonomy that you provide, and this is an argument. Again, you know, Susan might disagree with this, but this gets back to Susan's question about what the founders were thinking and ultimately how it was reflected in jurisprudence from the Supreme Court, including from Justice Brennan. But it's Susan, I think the closest manifestation of the reflection of natural law in our constitutional orbits is the Ninth Amendment. Here's how it reads. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. So the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Now, the Supreme Court has done very little with the Ninth Amendment. It's largely fallen into desuetude. It's largely forgotten. So no one listening to this podcast could win a case these days bringing a claim under the Ninth Amendment. But getting back to the question about the connection between law, neuroscience, and dignity, I think that's the closest that at least the United States Constitution comes to it.
Fascinating. And of course, we know why the Ninth Amendment was added, because the drafters of the Bill of Rights were concerned that by enumerating some rights, they would leave out all these other natural rights, which they understood also existed. And they want to make sure that all of that jurisprudence was incorporated into the Constitution. I think that all goes to the theme of what we're talking about. I have another question. I know, Terry, do you have?
Yeah, I was just going to ask the concept of natural rights. I guess one of the things that we struggle with is how kind of nature nurture question. In terms of natural, is this something that people might think, well, it has evolved over time that might be found in humans, but maybe not other animals? Or I'm just trying to get a handle on the notion of what a natural right is and where it comes from. I assume it's embedded in the brain somewhere if it's natural. That means we could go look for it. And that's, in many ways, I think that's the very interesting part of what Tara's doing. But I think the term natural, I guess I wonder if anyone could give me any more on that from a legal perspective. Or Tara, too, also.
Yeah, I can try, because I've been thinking about these issues in my own writing. But the concept of natural rights is a 17th century concept, which the idea was, and I think Jimmy started to explain this earlier on and did explain it, but I probably won't do as well as Jimmy did. But so it's the idea that there are rights that are not granted by positive law, meaning even if the law doesn't give you the right, you do actually inherently have that right. Another term is inalienable, which is used in our Declaration of Independence.
Is it the same as innate?
Yeah. I think very similar idea. Yes, yes. And sometimes it's connected with religious jurisprudence, but it doesn't have to be. It can be an utterly secular understanding. As, you know, sometimes the idea is that these rights are granted by the divine. But that's one strain of natural rights thinking, and it's not the only one. And another one is that it's secular and it's inherent in what it means to be a human being. And to me, that concept is very close to what Tara's work is about. And that's why I was trying to explore this, because I think, again, to use the term consilience, because I take that from E.O. Wilson. He writes about that, how biology and law and philosophy are achieving consilience on certain things. It seems to me that this might be what Tara's onto in her really important article. And that's what I was sort of trying to air that possibility in our conversation.
Well, Tara, are you thinking that these are innate? Because a lot of your work, you could also interpret it as these autonomy and so on can, well, not necessarily autonomy, but these various freedoms, certainly dignity, could emerge from environmental factors. And people who are exposed differently to those factors may not show the same amount of the concept. What do you think?
I mean, I think the term innate, you know, suggests some sort of like that you don't need to learn it.
I agree. Right? Yeah.
But I don't think that, yeah, but I think the term innate is getting more at like which part of this is biology, which part of this is environment. And yet, you know, at some level, that's sort of a red herring when it comes to actual real life, right? Because we're all biological organisms that are developing over time based on this sort of dance between our biology and the environment. And the fact that these, you know, environments are constantly feeding back on our neural systems, and that those are changing over time as a result of the plasticity of the system. I don't know that innate. I think that what we know from neuroscience and psychology is that these domains of dignity are robustly represented in the central nervous system, both in its structure, in its function, and the way it develops over time. So if you want to sort of term that as that these sort of domains of dignity are innate, I would agree with that. But I don't think it means that you're born whole with these things already developed, that there's a sensitivity, and you see it in these international declarations, a sensitivity to the periods of vulnerability and sensitivity to abuses of dignity that impact the brain and the nervous system because these domains are important and because of the plasticity of the human brain, even in adulthood. I don't know if that helps.
Yeah, I agree. I think part of the thing I was reacting to was this term natural and what it meant. I agree that, I mean, even epigenetics, when we have something that's, you know, genetic, it can be changed by the environment. I think most of us believe, there used to be battles between nature and nurture, but most of us believe that we're prepared biologically to interact with the environment in certain ways. I guess my question was, if natural is something, natural laws is something that neuroscientists should be concerned about, or whether it should be involved in the legal system as well.
Yeah, Terry, I think part of it is that the word means something really different in the two domains.
Okay, that's very likely. Right.
As innate in law as opposed to in
or natural. Natural.
Natural. I'm getting the sense that natural rights from a legal perspective are rights that are inherent to the human person and that they're not given by the state. Is that correct?
Correct. Right. Jimmy, would you agree?
Yes. What you mentioned earlier, Tara, about positive rights versus implied rights. You know, we are such positivists in the Western world. We look to see whether there's a law that covers something. And if it does, fine. And whatever isn't, to some people, whatever isn't prohibited is permitted. And to others, whatever isn't permitted is prohibited, you know, depending upon where you're sort of, where the moral hazards lie. But we look to see whether there's a positive right in the constitutional law, you know, like in the Bill of Rights in the United States, or an act of legislation or what have you. Natural rights come from someplace else. And largely natural rights are not reflected in law. And that goes back to cases decided by the U.S. Supreme Court 200 years ago, you know, Calder versus Bull, where the Supreme Court was addressing questions about whether there were natural rights under law that could be protected. And it said, no, if you want a right, vote. You know, if you want there to be a law, elect people who will put that into play.
it came up in Tara's interview as well, which is, and Jimmy, you mentioned it, the difference in emphasis between the values of autonomy, freedom, liberty in the Western traditions versus the greater focus on socioeconomic rights, such as freedom from want, the right to education, the right to a clean environment, clean water, that are more emphasized in the versions of dignity rights that we see in the global South and in the East. I'm curious, do either of you have thoughts about why the different emphasis? I mean, really, ideally, at least in my way of thinking, all of it needs to be there. The positive rights, the negative rights, the liberty, the autonomy, the agency, but also these rights to certain positive resources. Just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Okay, I'll throw in first here, and that is my thoughts about why there are differences. It's that it's too complicated to address in a soundbite or a sentence. It is super complicated, and it's bound up in history, tradition, custom, some would say evolution. And again, I don't know. I'm out of my depth here, but I'm wondering if there's any connection as well to neuroscience. But the truth of the matter is that the idea of human rights and how that's characterized is different depending upon where you were born, what religious system, if any, that you were a part of, what cultural systems you're a part of, whether you were born in the global north or the global south, whether you have indigenous connections or culture that feed that conversation as well. For example, you know, the idea of dignity, largely for indigenous communities, just goes without saying. There isn't a need for a law. There isn't a need for conversation, even about whether something is natural or positive or anything, you know, in many indigenous populations, both at the individual and at the community level, dignity is thought to be there. It's an inherent part of human existence. So there are certainly differences.
It seems just so fascinating to me. I mean, I don't know what the origin of the differences are here between, a focus on agency and autonomy as opposed to these socioeconomic rights across different cultures. But it strikes me that it seems to fall along the lines of individualistic as opposed to community-minded sort of social structures and cultural values. To my mind, it doesn't seem that these concepts of dignity are mutually exclusive regarding agency and autonomy as opposed to these socioeconomic rights and needs, but more one of emphasis that in a Western culture that this, you know, the individual is sort of supreme and as a result, agency tends to be the thing that drives the law. And maybe as a result, you get this, you know, Jimmy, what you said, that Western cultures and law tend to be really positivistic. And I think that's incredibly interesting because you can imagine from an individualistic point of view that unfettered rights to agency feed into a system in which rights to a clean, you know, clean water and clean air, those things aren't as implied rights, that those things need to actually be articulated positively in the law in order to be defended. That's just really interesting.
Yeah, I think it's super interesting too. And it also, again, underscores the import, if you will, the magical nature of dignity in law and in neuroscience. So you just mentioned clean air and clean water. This idea of everyone having a right to a healthy environment has taken on a certain kind of cultural salience in the last decade or so. But it hardly finds much of a landing in law. Even though there are, by my count, 84 countries that recognize a right to a healthy environment, there are only a handful of cases that try to enforce that right. When we talk about environmental rights, and which would arguably, you know, be incorporated in the idea of everyone's autonomy and agency, there's very little the law has done about it. But you know what has done a lot about it? Dignity. So dignity in law has been a station for advancing environmental human rights all across the globe. A leading case, for example, is out of Pakistan. So the Pakistani constitution guarantees a right to human dignity. It's right in the constitution. Courts in Pakistan have translated that provision as providing environmental rights, A, and B, requiring the government, for example, to do more to address greenhouse gas emissions. So that's, again, sort of the superpower of dignity under law. But Tara, we see it in all of the different domains that you mentioned as well, like with the agency and autonomy part of it. Courts all across the globe have turned to a right to human dignity to uphold participatory rights, you know, rights to vote, assemble, petition, the rights to education, for example. The freedom from want is reflected, again, all around the globe, including in cases about the environment, as you just mentioned, but also about the right to basic subsistence. Courts in Germany, for example, have turned to the basic right, which is the very first right, the Uber right in the German Constitution, is a right to human dignity. It's the only right that can't be undone in the German Constitution, but have turned to that in all sorts of ways, including upholding basic welfare rights for citizens as well as for immigrants. The freedom from fear has largely found a home in dignity jurisprudence when it comes to people are subject to the criminal justice system all around the globe. There are leading cases in Malawi and South Africa and Kenya and Colombia and Nepal about prison conditions. And courts have turned to rights to dignity to require better conditions. There's a first of its kind case in the United States that's been brought in the United States District Court for the District of Delaware that's pending right now, that's challenging the Delaware Department of Corrections treatment or maltreatment of dozens of prisoners in facilities in Delaware. And part of that is based upon a right to dignity. So we see that freedom from fear expressed there, and then uniqueness to the extent across the globe that there's unanimity about dignity and LGBTQ rights and rights of the transgender community. That's largely through a right to dignity. It's not through an expressed right to, you know, expressed right for LGBTQ communities. It's through the right to human dignity that those rights are upheld. And then on unconditionality, we see this all across the globe, courts turning to, at least the way that I see how it's reflected, is courts turning to the government's relationship with individuals and with families about parenting and ultimately, because I know, Tara, you talk about unconditionality, the way at least I read it, it's about the dividend that unconditional support and love plays throughout one's life and also how that echoes throughout the community. In dignity law, we see courts turning to community rights and dignity. There's a leading case out of Nigeria about that comes up in concerning burning of methane by the Shell oil company. It was having an incredible effect on a neighboring community. Largely, it's an environmental case, but the court thought of it as a dignity case because ultimately pollution, living in a polluted society, made it impossible to own one's dignity, including protect one's family and engage in the community in a variety of ways. So I guess my point is that the more I think about it, the more I'm thinking of, you know, getting back maybe to Terry's question, the more I'm thinking about how there is a direct line between dignity, rights, and law and the domains of dignity that you've described.
That's a great summary of so much of what's the developing jurisprudence. And let's hope the U.S. starts to think along these lines as well. We can only hope. Terry, any final questions?
The big one, I think, as you referred to it, was agency and dignity and law and neuroscience and what is meant by this. I think I'd like to have Tara, given that we have a little more background on law, I know that Tara has her paper has a lot to do with agency and autonomy. I wonder if she would have some comments about the role of agency in dignity law and autonomy in dignity law to the perspective of a neuroscientist.
My sense is that in terms of international agreements on universal human rights, that agency is a big part of a lot of those articles. I mean, from a neuroscience perspective and a psychological perspective, agency is really important for individuals' well-being. I'm approaching agency as the processes and structures that are involved in translating motivation into action. Agency is the way that we impact the world voluntarily. And it's really an essential component of positive emotion, of engagement, of joy and vigor in everyday life. And so I think as a psychological construct, but also as a neurobiological phenomena, that agency is really an important component of everyday life. I think that Jimmy's insight in Dignity Law, that everyone is inherently equal and that no individual's rights supersede any other individual's rights. In the domain of agency, that has profound implications, such that one individual's sort of vision can never supersede another person's agentic expression in the world. And so I think that that's really a cornerstone, and it's deeply respectful of the makeup of human beings, you know, both biologically, but psychologically.
So I see that your work as a way of trying to bridge between neuroscience and law. And an earlier question I had was, what can neuroscience do to support the concept of dignity in the legal domain? And so my question is, how close are we, you think? I know that you're trying to, and it's an intrepid effort, trying to make these links. How close do you think we are to being able to take neuroscience data and translate that into something that can be used in a court of law?
I think we're at the very beginning of this, of sort of exploring this shared space between dignity law and dignity neuroscience. And I think it's really exciting, but we're definitely at the beginning. I don't know myself exactly how these ideas in neuroscience would directly apply to, you know, the legal forum or in an active court case. But I do know that the day after I published this paper, I got a very lengthy email from a woman in, I believe it was Austin, Texas, who was part of the homeless community, and that she was having to interact with the court system because she was a victim of domestic violence. And she really saw a hope in these ideas in terms of helping her case, that she had rights that needed to be protected for the following reasons. And I found it was just so moving to me that she, and one imagines that, you know, this is a person without a home. One imagines that somehow she found my paper on social media and then went to the public library and accessed it on a publicly available computer and then found my email and sent me this really beautifully composed, lengthy, articulate email about the ways in which these ideas would play out in her court case, but also in the court cases of the people in her homeless community in Texas. And I thought that just blew me away. And so I don't have an answer to that question, but I have a feeling that there are ways that this can grow and inform law and maybe help fortify these rights. Jimmy, do you have ideas?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this link between neuroscience and dignity has two predicates. One is that it requires that there be cases about dignity. Again, that's yet to be explored, especially in the United States. There are some exceptions, as I mentioned, this case in Delaware. There are some cases in Montana, but there's a constitutional right there, and in Puerto Rico. So first, you need a claim based on dignity. The second is the science behind it, which is how I interpret the question, is to what extent can these connections inform a case that's trying to uphold a right to dignity. So this gets into admissibility in court cases. It's tough. It falls under something called the Daubert or Daubert standard. It's a famous case in law that stands for the proposition that a trial judge has to assess whether an expert witness's scientific testimony is based on scientifically valid reasoning, which can properly be applied to the facts in the case. So, Tara, I think you're right. It's often the future. So it requires first a case. And then secondly, it requires a judge to find that there is enough there to admit that expert testimony, like your expert testimony in a case that's based on dignity.
I think the day will come when that will happen.
You'll be hearing cheering from at least four people I know. So Tara, here's a question we haven't talked about, and it's not addressed in your paper. So feel free to just take a pass on this. I'm just curious what you think about it. So it begins with law and dignity. So, you know, the law of human dignity is vast and ever expanding, like the universe or something. A brand new area of it addresses whether and the extent to which dignity applies to nature. So there's one constitution that recognizes nature as having legal personality. It's through the concept, sort of a little bit calling back to an earlier topic of conversation about who has dignity and so on. It's whether nature does. So it's the concept of Pachamama, which is this indigenous concept in indigenous cultures that, you know, the earth is mother earth, and that it also has rights. So the Ecuadorian constitution says that Pachamama has legal rights. Then there are some countries that have recognized or granted legal personification to rivers, like New Zealand has, Bolivia has. And then there are court cases that have recognized legal rights for nature, primarily for rivers, but also for glaciers and other systems, leading cases out of Colombia with the Rio Atrato. So I'm just curious. Oh, I'm sorry. The common thread throughout all of those, you know what's coming, right? Is dignity, is a right to human dignity. And so I'm wondering what you think about, I mean, given you've given so much thought to the relationship between dignity and neuroscience, if we're talking about a being that can't apply to, if we can still have a conversation about dignity in that context.
So I love this question. This actually also came up during the peer review of the Annals paper, because it was raised, like, the question of who has dignity. Like, do you need to be a human being to have dignity? Do you even need to have a brain to have dignity, right? Like, where are the ends of dignity? And I think here, I would say in terms of dignity neuroscience, that this is sort of articulating the mechanics, you know, the biological mechanics of intrinsic human dignity. And so I think the fact that we have not one but two adjectives in front of dignity in that case is maybe we can build on that, right? That maybe the concept of dignity per se and intrinsic human dignity are, maybe clearly there's overlap, but maybe we can discriminate those. And also in terms of these indigenous and cross-cultural concepts of dignity that are much broader than a Western approach, where we very atomized it and individualized it as being within the individual human person, and instead of a larger concept of dignity. I don't see them as mutually exclusive at all. I think that there's clearly interdigitation and a conversation amongst these different varieties of dignity. In my work with dignity neuroscience, I was just trying to use what we know in neuroscience and psychology to support these larger domains that have been pretty clearly articulated at the international level in terms of what dignity entails in law. But I think it's a much larger question as to what these overarching and overriding concepts of dignity, as they apply to other species and the health of the planet as a whole, are really interesting. Operationally, I would say that the domains of dignity that I've talked about, and then also you, Jimmy, have talked about, really you can use those in environmental efforts to try to support rights for, say, clean air, clean water. And you don't need to rely necessarily on concepts of dignity of the river itself to support those cases. I think it's really a fascinating question. And it also speaks to these different cultural concepts of what it is to be human and what our place is in the natural world.
Yeah, and maybe it gets back also to Susan's reference to E.O. Wilson from earlier, that maybe, not to get philosophical, I'm not a philosopher either, you know. I know very little about anything, okay? But it's this idea of consilience, that we are all one.
Different disciplines are moving in similar directions.
So I think that this has a lot of implications. I think the last time we talked with Tara was emphasizing in her paper as well that autonomy can be, for example, evidence for autonomy comes from the term contingency, where animals, if they can't learn a relationship between two events, then they their behavior in an event, they are not autonomous, but most animals can. And that goes all the way down to a sea slug. And so the notion of dignity rights with respect to animals would seem to be a kind of, it seemed to certainly come from that point of view.
Well, I think that raises super interesting questions. I know we're probably out of time, but curious to hear what Tara thinks about that as well. So Tara, you know, the human brain isn't that different than the brain of very similar to other primates. It's very similar to other animals, particularly like what Ed Yost has written about recently and so many others. There's a lot of neurology in the world. And, you know, it's vast and it's diverse. And like Terry mentioned, sea slugs, you know, they're social, they learn, they adapt, they respond. And we see that in fish and butterflies and, you know, throughout the, what we call the animal kingdom. And some would even extend that to plants as well, to trees and trees communicating. So what do you think about that? Is there neuroscience there? And if so, does that help answer the question about dignity neuroscience?
Tara, what do you think about trees communicating? I'm just joking.
I mean, I think here, you know, when we're talking about intrinsic human dignity and the biological features that we all share that support that dignity, and I think it's really, we've here articulated five domains of dignity. And I think in exploring this interface between the law, philosophy, and neuroscience, we're starting to populate what the construct of dignity entails when we're talking about people. And in doing this, I really tried very hard to rely only on human neuroscience data and information, in part because it's my hope that this effort can help sort of fortify and further international rights and local rights efforts in terms of defending and promoting human rights and these ideas of dignity. But it's not my intention to restrict these concepts to human beings, not at all. And I think in some ways what we have here between the legal side and the neuroscience side might be a template by which to approach what is articulating dignity for other entities, and not just simply taking my five domain framework and slapping it onto, you know, what we might think about dignity in another species, but taking a hard look at the ecology and the biology of each of those species, you could envision and or imagine that you could articulate what is the intrinsic dignity of that for that type of being. That might be a way forward. I know that it's certainly, you see approaches like that there aren't termed in terms of dignity, but there are legal structure for protecting, for instance, primates in research and other species in research. Every animal lab in the country goes under IACUC regulations. And so I feel like there are legal answers to what dignity looks like in other species already on the books. I really love the fact that I just started from a place where I'm thinking, you know, we know a lot about the neuroscience behind these domains of dignity that have already been clearly articulated in international and national law. But the fact that we could possibly use this approach to help inform our respect for and promotion of dignity in other species and the planet as a whole is really interesting.
Well, this has been kind of a mind-blowing discussion for me. Just wonderful. Opened so many paths for further thought and discussion in later episodes. I know everybody's busy, and so I probably want to call this conversation to an end, unless there's anything anybody wants to add in conclusion.
Yeah, I was just say thank you to Jimmy and Tara for participating today. It was very enlightening and thought-provoking, and that's always fun.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you so much for bringing the four of us together. I think, you know, we're talking across vast scholarly differences and disciplinary differences, but despite speaking across difference, we're all converging in our interests. And I think there's a lot of interplay between these ideas, and I'm really excited to see how they might, you know, develop as time goes on.
Yeah, and I'll just finish by saying that this conversation about dignity neuroscience has had the effect of, has had a neurological effect on me, giving, you know, to think more about the underpinnings of dignity in neurology and then what it means in law and in life. Anyway, thank you so much for inviting me to be a part of this podcast as well. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, that's it for this podcast episode. Thanks very much for listening. And as always, we welcome your feedback at neuroscience.policy@american.edu. We hope you'll join us again for our next episode. And do let us know if there's anything in particular you'd like to hear more about.